It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 39 degrees under fair skies. At the airport, they are indicating west winds at 14 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly sunny skies today, although with a 30% chance of snow showers after 4 this afternoon. West winds to 15, gusting to 20. Look for a high likelihood of snow showers between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. tonight. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies, low around 20. Southwest winds to 10, gusting to 20. And there's a likelihood of snow showers tomorrow, too, mainly after 4 in the afternoon. Mostly cloudy tomorrow as well, with a high near 30. West winds to 10, turning to the south tomorrow afternoon. Coming up on the Midday Report, subsistence deer hunters in Kodiak will be allowed 4 deer this year. Comfish is on its way, happening this week. And Senator Lisa Murkowski says money headed to the YK Delta for a wide-ranging number of infrastructure is overdue.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Cheers and applause went up from a crowd in Indiana as the solar eclipse made its way across the state just a short time ago. NPR's Scott Newman is in the city of Muncie, which is in the path of totality. He describes the phenomenon as a diamond ring in the sky.
You can see the shimmering corona around the edges. I think I can see Bailey's bead, one of Bailey's beads, that kind of effect that you get right around the Terminator on the moon, and it is just it's spectacular. I do apologize that words fail me, but it really is.
That's NPR Scott Newman reporting. Dozens of cities across the northeastern U.S. were also in the path of totality, or where the sun's visibility is completely blocked by the moon. That was the case in Plattsburgh, New York, as NPR's Lakshmi Singh reports.
Many people with whom I've spoken drove hours, 6, 7, 8 hours to get here to this spot. For some of them, this is the second time, another a third time. A lot of these folks, first time, didn't want to miss it.
That's NPR's Lakshmi Singh reporting from Plattsburgh, New York. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has announced his campaign's policy on abortion. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports Trump's remarks on social media came months after mixed signals about his stance on the issue.
Trump said on Truth Social that abortion should be left up to the states, meaning that he declined to support a federal abortion ban.
Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be.
He also explicitly took credit for overturning Roe v. Wade. The Biden campaign has been emphasizing Trump's connection to the overturn, as abortion has proven motivating not only for Democrats but many independent voters. Just weeks ago, Trump had expressed openness to a 15-week federal abortion ban. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
President Biden is making a stop in the key swing state of Wisconsin today. Speaking in Madison, Biden outlined the details of a new proposal to help student loan borrowers cut interest payments.
Today, too many Americans, especially young people, are saddled with unsustainable debts in exchange for a college degree. The ability for working and middle-class folks to repay their student loans has become so burdensome that a lot can't repay it for even decades after being in school.
One plan offers interest relief of up to $20,000, regardless of income level. This is NPR News in Washington. Lawmakers are returning to Capitol Hill today after an extended recess. One of the items topping the agenda is a Senate impeachment trial for Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Lawmakers on the House side are expected to open debate on additional military aid for Israel and Ukraine. A bipartisan group of lawmakers in Washington has announced new legislation aimed at protecting Americans' data online. NPR's Bobby Allen reports supporters say it could eventually become the nation's first comprehensive data privacy law.
The legislation, if passed, will set a national privacy standard that lawmakers say is stronger than any existing state laws. The proposal seeks to give Americans control over their personal data, including new protections against data brokers who routinely sell personal data based on a user's web activity. The legislation also lets people opt out of targeted advertising and the ability to sue companies that violate online privacy protections. The bipartisan bill is being pushed by lawmakers in the House and the Senate, but its prospects remain uncertain. The U.S. has long lagged behind the European Union in passing laws that protect digital rights and privacy online. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Salvage crews have started to remove containers from the cargo ship that crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in the port of Baltimore last month. Officials say the removal of the containers marks a critical step in the process of freeing the ship from the remains of the bridge. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 11 points. This is NPR News.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Cardiac Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. Federally qualified subsistence deer hunters in the Kodiak Archipelago will be able to take 4 black-tailed deer annually. Hunters are currently only allowed 3 deer between August and the end of January. That was part of the proposal passed by the Federal Subsistence Board at its meeting in Anchorage recently. On Thursday, the board took up a proposal that would have eliminated the current antlerless deer hunting restriction in Unit 8, an area that covers the entire Kodiak Archipelago. That would have allowed hunters to also harvest does and fawns, which is currently prohibited from August to October. The Kodiak Regional Advisory Council asked the board to consider a modification to the original proposal that would retain the antlerless deer restriction. The council's chair, Rebecca Skinner, says allowing antlerless deer to be taken between August and January would encourage the inadvertent harvesting of does and fawns, which is contrary to Aleutic values.
Given that newborn fawns are commonly delivered as early as mid-June, there is apprehension that an earlier extension of the antlerless season may lead to the unintended harvesting of does with young fawns, potentially orphaning these vulnerable offspring.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game sided with the Kodiak RAC and supported keeping the restriction as well. State liaison Ben Mulligan says harvesting female antlerless deer could have a negative impact on the local population.
Because we still hear from locals there are concerns regarding the reduction in deer abundance and harvest opportunity, an increase in female deer harvest should be carefully considered as this proposal could slow population growth and lead to prolonged population recovery times after experiencing any severe winter events.
Severe winters are believed to be one of the main causes for the Kodiak Island deer population's decline at various times over the last few decades, going all the way back to before the regulation was first imposed in 2002. Kendra Holman, a wildlife biologist with the Office of Subsistence Management, says there was no biological data to support keeping the antlerless restriction and asked the board to pass the proposal without it. According to Holman, the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge has done winter browse surveys of black-tailed deer on the island and says the overall population has not decreased recently nor warrants conservation concerns. The regulation changes for harvest limits will go into effect on July 1st. This does not change the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's hunting regulations for non-residents who can only take 1 buck a year in the Kodiak Road System Management Area. Kodiak's annual commercial fisheries trade show, ComFish, is this week. Ellen Simeonoff is the executive director of the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce, which organizes the trade show. It's her first year lining out the booths and contacting presenters, but she says she was grateful for the help of the ComFish committee.
They help, determine the blueprint of the forums
and, you know, how that's going to look and sound.
This year, the expo will be held in the Kodiak Marketplace, featuring 46 booths spread between the top and ground floors. Marine equipment suppliers, harvester groups, banks, and state agencies like the health department will all have tables set up throughout the event. Forums will be held in the harbor room of the Best Western, about a block away. Some of the in-person presentations will feature U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang, and Alaska House Representative Louise Stutes. ConFish starts on Wednesday with Fish Taco Night at the Kodiak Island Brewing Tasting Room. The trade show ends the following Saturday. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski has applauded more than $50 million in federal funding headed for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. That's thanks to a wide-ranging appropriations package recently passed by Congress. KYUK's Evan Erickson reports.
Highlights for the region include funding of around $6 million each for the villages of Chifornik and Makoriak to build their first-ever running water and wastewater collection systems. Additionally, the coastal village of Hooper Bay is receiving funding for two separate projects. The need for both, Murkowski says, became apparent when she visited the village in the aftermath of Typhoon Murbach in 2022.
It was very clear that their barge landing facility needed to be addressed. Murbach had not been kind.
In addition to $5 million for a new barge landing and road, $1.5 million will be going to waste collection and landfill improvements for Hooper Bay.
And I asked to go see the landfill. And the landfill was as maxed out and as inadequate as any landfill I've seen across the state.
For Bethel, a range of projects have received funding, including $5 million for removing derelict vessels from the nearby steamboat slough. The issue has been a source of friction for at least a decade, and who exactly is responsible for the cleanup has been unclear.
I know Coast Guard says, well, okay, they're not navigational hazards, they're not environmental hazards, but you know what? They are. I've been out there in the summertime, and you have to maneuver your skiff around in the wintertime. I know there can be obstacles for snow machiners as they're running down the slough. It's just not a safe, it's not something that should be allowed to continue.
Also for Bethel, $3 million will be going to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation for a project to construct around 120 units of new employee housing. The healthcare provider has previously said the project is critical for recruiting and retaining new employees amid a sustained housing shortage in Bethel.
We heard very clearly the need from YKHC. There's got to be more done to get housing so that they can have the staffing that they need.
Additionally, $2 million will go to fund renovations and repairs to the Bethel Family Clinic building. Finally, the city's only homeless shelter, Bethel Winter House, has been awarded $300,000 for individual case management. As for public safety, a press release from Murkowski's office also includes mention, without specifying a funding total, of Senator Murkowski's support of efforts to stem the flow of illegal drugs into rural Alaska through the federal high-intensity drug trafficking areas program.
The real key here is keeping these drugs from getting into the villages. And we know that some of the small villages have been targeted, everything from Quinnahawk to Togiak. And it has developed into such a lucrative financial gain for the dealers that they're working aggressively to build up the Alaska market in remote areas. And that, to me, is frightening. We've got to unite together to make sure that these awful, poisonous drugs that are killing our people do not come into the community.
The full list of Alaska projects contained in the appropriations package is pages long and spans the entire state. Murkowski says she is pleased to see multiple projects from the YK region previously put on the back burner get the funding they need. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
The rail belt is facing a major energy crunch. The region needs to find a replacement for Cook Inlet natural gas, which is used to generate most power from Homer to Fairbanks. One study suggests that over the long term, the cheapest option is to ramp up renewable energy. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports on what is possible.
In 2022, Cook Inlet's largest natural gas producer, Hilcorp, announced it could not guarantee a gas supply to the rail belt beyond the next few years. Philip White is an energy historian at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says it's not that Cook Inlet is out of natural gas, but it's become too expensive to produce locally.
We are a small market, and it is not worth it for many oil and gas companies to come into the Cook Inlet, a mature basin where most of the gas has already been removed, to try to encourage more production.
That's a problem for communities on the Rail Belt. Two-thirds of the region's electricity is currently generated from Cook Inlet natural gas. So electric utilities are scrambling to come up with new energy sources. One option is to ship in liquefied natural gas on tankers from Canada. But importing natural gas is expensive and prices are unpredictable. A recent study from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory says longer term, the cheaper option is to aggressively build out renewable energy sources like solar and wind farms. Paul Denholm is an energy analyst who authored the study. He says Alaska will likely have to import some amount of natural gas no matter what, but
by building quite a bit of wind and solar energy, we can dramatically reduce the amount of that costly natural gas burned, and we can reduce the price of electricity, or at least really keep it from rising as much.
That would also be more in line with global climate targets, which require transitioning away from fossil fuels. Natural gas is a major contributor to climate change. But how quickly could Alaska really build out a ton of renewables? Currently, about 15% of Rail Belt electricity comes from renewable sources, mostly hydropower. The study found in the most affordable scenario, renewables would grow to provide more than 3/4 of electricity generation by 2040. Denholm says that would require building major new wind and solar farms along with battery storage. In this scenario, for example, wind power would go from providing just 2% of Rail Belt electricity today to more than half within 15 years. That's a lot of infrastructure to build in a short period of time.
One challenge, of course, is that there's relatively little historic development of wind and solar. You don't have lots of different developers in the area kind of ready to bring in the trucks and the cranes and all that. So there would be a challenge of getting that infrastructure in place to avoid all of that natural gas.
Chugach Electric Association is the largest of 5 electric utilities serving the Rail Belt. CEO Arthur Miller says he hasn't reviewed the NREL study in detail. He says the utility is pursuing major wind and solar projects, but renewables introduce their own complications.
I think renewables and clean energy technologies in general are absolutely essential as we move forward. I think the big challenge, or a big challenge in the Rail Belt, is the integration of those renewables into the generation mix.
Wind and solar are variable resources. That's different from traditional options like natural gas or hydropower, which utilities can turn on and off as needed. Basically, the more wind or solar you have on the grid, the more flexible and connected the grid needs to be. White, the UAF energy historian, says this transformation is possible, but it will require major changes in how utilities do business. The biggest hurdle, he says, is establishing better coordination between the 5 utilities. Utilities would also have to build a lot of big projects really quickly, and they'd likely have to cooperate with private wind and solar developers to reach targets in time.
Utilities are not used to running the grid this way, so it's going to take a cultural change. It's going to take innovation in order to get there.
Lawmakers are currently considering a proposal that would require utilities to ramp up renewables more quickly, but it's unclear whether it will pass. In the shorter term, Chugach is considering the expensive option of importing natural gas from Canada and looking for ways to keep Cook Inlet natural gas flowing. Everyone agrees as utilities figure out the energy transition, Alaskans are likely to be in for at least a few years of high electric bills. But White says he remains hopeful that the state will figure it out.
We have built big things in the past. I know we can do so again in the future. And it's just really a question of social and political will.
Because the technology, White says, already exists. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Anchorage officials are trying to create some clear structure and guidance for people who will be living in Anchorage without homes this summer. The idea is to close some of the public safety and nuisance issues that come up after winter shelters closed last year. On Tuesday, the Anchorage Assembly is expected to hold a public hearing and vote on an ordinance to limit the size of encampments, keep them away from existing year-round shelters, and create safe parking areas for people living in their cars. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Last year, when the city's winter shelters closed, officials had little guidance for the hundreds of people being put out. Encampments on vacant city land and in wooded areas ballooned all over town, along with hosts of problems within encampments and in the surrounding neighborhoods. Meg Zalatel is the head of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, which worked with Mayor Dave Bronson's administration to develop the proposed ordinance.
On our side, making clear expectations for those who are in encampments, we think is really important. Last summer, it was very unclear. And it created a lot of uncertainty.
Zalatel, who is also the vice chair of the assembly, says being clearer about where camps will and won't be tolerated will make outreach and education easier. The city's homelessness coordinator, Alexis Johnson, explained.
We'll have a map handy that says, hey, this is where you will have the least amount of trouble if you set up camp here. These are no-go zones. Please do not set up here. In establishing that relationship prior to a majority of shelter letting out so that people know where they can go in town and not have issues.
Zalatel says limiting the size of camps will also make outreach safer and more manageable. The size limit hasn't been set yet, but in committee, city officials kicked around limits between 25 and 50 tents or similar shelters. Zalatel says barring campsites near existing shelters is helpful for keeping those clients on track. For example, she says someone trying to stay sober in a shelter would not immediately be confronted by people drinking.
What we often see and we've seen before, particularly on Third Avenue, is that if you are able to go to shelter and you are in shelter and you want to leave shelter to attend to your appointments or anything else, if camping is right there, and large encampments in particular, you are inundated.
The last significant change the ordinance proposes is to create some city oversight and permitting for designated safe parking areas. The idea is that a church, nonprofit, or government agency could make their property available for up to 50 vehicles for people to stay in. City health and planning officials would have to sign off that certain public health and safety issues were covered to get the designation. At its peak this winter, the city paid for more than 600 people a night to have a safe place to sleep. Johnson says some pieces of that system are already scaling down, with a complete closure scheduled for May 31st. Altogether, she expects about 900 people to go unsheltered in Anchorage this summer. She says it's far more expensive to manage the impacts of that population when they leave shelter, in terms of things like police and paramedic calls, emergency room visits, and cleanups at camps. But there might be some relief coming from the state. Legislators working on the state operating budget recently added a $4 million grant to keep the city's 200-bed shelter in a former administrative building running through the summer. As just one small piece of a far bigger spending proposal, it's far from guaranteed. But through a spokesperson, Mayor Bronson says homelessness in Anchorage affects the entire state, and he appreciates the legislature's attention to the issue. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The solar eclipse economy is outshining April's past. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute. Usually, this is a slow period for tourism in many parts of the country now inundated with visitors. Airbnb says occupancy for listings along today's eclipse path are around 90%. Hotel room prices around Niagara Falls have more than tripled. Hertz says car rental bookings are up 3,000%. In Baltimore, salvage crews have begun moving containers off the cargo ship that crashed into the Key Bridge. Vessel access to the city's port remains limited to temporary channels. The Biden administration is canceling accrued interest on student loan debt for millions of borrowers. Many owe more than what they originally borrowed, despite years of payments. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute.
Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 8th day of April, the year 2024. Sun rose today at 7:16. It will set again at 9:07. That will give us 13 hours and 51 minutes of daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 57 seconds. Our record high temperature for this date was 57. That was set in 1929. And our record low was 10 degrees set in 1986. Currently 39 degrees under fair skies. West winds at 14 miles per hour at the airport. They are also showing 10 full miles of visibility. Look for a 30% chance of snow showers this afternoon, not till after 5 or so. Otherwise, mostly sunny skies, high near 38, west winds to 15, gusting to 20. Snow showers are likely between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. tonight, and mostly cloudy skies after that, low around 20, west winds to 10, gusting as high as 20. And they're expecting those clouds to clump up again and produce more snow showers tomorrow, mainly after 5 p.m. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a high near 30, west winds to 10, turning to the north tomorrow afternoon. Looks like more snow showers for Tuesday night and Wednesday. Just mostly cloudy skies for Wednesday night. Rain coming back on Thursday. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 2:41 p.m. and be 8.1 feet, followed by a low tide at 8:55 p.m. of minus 3/10. We will be having another significant low tide tomorrow morning, tide poolers. That will happen at 9:11 tomorrow morning and be minus 1.9 feet on the east side, pretty far out. On the west side, your next high tide will happen at 3:13 this afternoon and be 15.3 feet in Larson Bay. And your low tide will happen at 9:17 this evening and be minus 8/10. And your significant low tide on the west side will happen at 9:48 a.m. and be minus 3.3 feet in Larson Bay. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tomorrow. West winds to 25 knots, becoming west 30 tonight. 7-foot seas today and tonight with freezing spray beginning tonight. For tomorrow, west 30, except north of Dangerous Cape, southwest 20, becoming variable 10. Seas to 7 feet tomorrow and freezing spray on our east side. For tomorrow night, northwest 30, seas to 5 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning for tomorrow, west 30 today, becoming northwest 30. 7-foot seas, becoming 6-foot seas tonight with freezing spray beginning tonight in the Shelikof. For tomorrow, northwest 35, seas to 7 feet with freezing spray. We do have some meetings coming up here in the Kodiak Island Borough this week, beginning with tomorrow's meeting of the Service Area No. 1 Board. They will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow. On Wednesday, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And on Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Next Monday, the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting. That happens at the Providence Barometer Conference Room and at 3 p.m. An ongoing series about agriculture in Kodiak. It's a community learning series put on by the Kodiak Harvest Food Co-op and Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District continues on Wednesday. Between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m., you will be able to learn about growing in hoop houses on Kodiak. Great subject. Meet at the Touch Tank building on Near Island between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday. It can be attended on Zoom as well. The link to do that is on the Facebook event page. Panelists include Amanda Olson, Amanda Johnson of the Kodiak Middle School Agricultural Program, Andy Olson, Ian Zacker of Brown Bear Farm, and Craig Sanders of NCRS. And it's coming up, the Diamond Jubilee of the Kodiak Arts Council's Art and Adventure Auction. Art and Adventure. You must be 21 or older to attend, so you know it's fun. They're celebrating 60 years of service to Kodiak, and it's all happening April 20th at the Kodiak Marketplace. You can get early bird tickets for $20, I suppose, at the Arts Council website, and tickets at the door for $25. Doors open at 6, full bar, silent auction, and 7 p.m. the live auction begins. You can become a Diamond Jubilee table sponsor. Just give them a call at 907-942-5840.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181. Fax us at 486-2733 or email psa@kmxt.org.